Hey everybody, welcome to Flaherty's on Films. This week we're talking about Citizen Kane.
Hit the music!
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Orson Welles. I'm speaking for the Mercury Theater, and what follows is supposed to advertise our first motion picture. Citizen Kane is the title, and we hope it can correctly be called a coming attraction. It's certainly coming to this theater, and I think our Mercury actors make it an attraction. I'd like you to meet them. Speaking of attractions, well, the chorus girls are certainly an attraction, but frankly, ladies and gentlemen, we're just showing you the chorus girls for purposes of ballyhoo. It's pretty nice ballyhoo.
Hello, everybody. This is Flaherty's on Films. This is the best podcast on the internet. My name is Michael Flaherty.
And I'm Colleen Flaherty.
This week, we're talking about Citizen Kane.
Because this is what the podcast is all about. We talk about movies.
We have to say it every time what this is.
We do.
They're subscribed. They know what it is.
They might not be. This might be their first episode.
I know what they're all like.
This is a podcast where we talk about the AFI, but not after today. Because this is the number one, our 100th movie podcast.
After today, a bumper begins.
That's
a song.
You were so confident starting that song that you do not know the lyrics.
I got it 100%. I mean, the melody is the best part.
That's true. Citizen Kane. Michael, what is it about? What does IMDb say?
Luckily, we have it written down, so I'll read it. Following the death of publishing tycoon Charles Foster Kane, reporters scramble to uncover the meaning of his final utterance, Rosebud.
That was so good, Michael. Good job.
Thank you for reading.
Yeah.
I'm a good reader.
You have a great voice, great attitude. I like it all. Michael, what did you think of this film?
I have seen it before. Before I saw the previous viewing, I remember liking it. This time I also liked it. But even though I did, I feel like it doesn't really stick with me.
Yep.
But I like the character of Foster Kane. I think he's fun to watch.
I also think that. I was so surprised because I had to put together some one-star reviews. And a lot of the complaints are like the things I hate most about movies. Like, it's too long, it's boring, it's pretentious, it's nonsense. And honestly, I'm usually a person, if someone tells me this is the best movie ever, I'm like probably going to hate it because it's an expectations versus what you're actually seeing. So I'm a little surprised that I have pretty middling reactions. Like, it's fine. You know?
We can talk about this later, but I think it foregoes the pretentiousness because it is kind of silly. It is kind of lighthearted in its presentation.
I mean, like, I think I get why it's number one on a film list. Like, it's got a lot of neat tricks.
Which is what they love.
People love the neat tricks and the mirrors. And
they should
and
try spinning.
So I get it, though. Like, even to someone who doesn't get anything about film like me, like, I'm like, oh, that seems innovative and interesting.
Like, you but know what shadows are.
Yeah, but it's also less than 2 hours long. Like, it's not that long.
And I don't even think it's pretentious.
The characters are really fun. Like, yeah. And I remember, so I saw this movie, I think, when I was in college, because we study it in J school. Because, like,
J school.
Sorry, journalism school.
That's what they call it?
Yeah, that's like a thing.
We call it no other words start with J. What if I'm studying Jaguars? Do I just not get to say that about my school?
You would want to tell everybody.
Right, I want to say the word.
Yeah. And then my asshole friend Dave
although
would be
I
like...
Although I would be like, hey, I'm in J school. Oh, journalism. And I would go, no. Jaguar school. I would like it every time.
My asshole friend David would be like, oh, that's Jaguar. That's how they say it. That's how his people...
I mean, whatever keeps the discussion going, because I just love talking about my Jaguar school experience.
Anyway, let's go to our first segment, fan favorite. And I think podcast host favorite, Bam.
Time for Sam.
This is the part of the show where our friend Samantha comes on and tells us some really cool facts about the movie
She's related to us. She's our cousin.
She's our cousin. And our friend. She can be two things.
I didn't say there's exclusionary. Is that a word? Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, first off, I would like to congratulate you two on reaching number one on the list.
Woo, we did it.
Go us. Man, we're good.
And also, thank you guys so much for letting me be a part of it. It's always fun hanging
with...
We
were very gracious to let you do this.
Yeah.
This is a nice thing of us.
It was so nice of us to let you do most of the work for this
podcast. We're very kind.
You guys are two of the coolest people I know, so it's just really fun hanging with you and learning about these films. So
I'm waiting for the compliment back to her. It's coming.
Okay.
Sam is the best person
ever. Yeah, there it is.
So,
why didn't you do it?
Nah, I was waiting for you.
So fact time. Are you guys ready for my first fact?
I'm so ready.
I'm so excited.
Okay, I had to really do a good job because this is the last film. Ready?
You're about to be fired if it's not good.
Here we go. Here's your fact. William Dafoe is from Appleton, Wisconsin.
Oh, what a good fact!
Right? And Orson Welles was born in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
No way!
Damn.
I didn't know that.
Those are the two biggest movie stars.
Bringing it back around.
The one film. Orson Welles would have made such a good Spider-Man villain. Who do you think he should have been? Think he should have been the Lizard?
Octo. Dr. Oct.
He has that really good voice.
Yeah.
You have to give him a really good voice part.
Green Goblin. You like that?
Mr. Jameson.
Made it up myself.
Kenosha people have the most hilarious accent ever. No offense to people from Kenosha.
Not Orson Welles.
I know. Yeah, he just has... I bet he worked on that accent.
He
like,
moved to Chicago for a while, and then he actually went to school in Madison, which is where we're recording this. And
he
then,
doesn't sound like he's from the Midwest
And then
all.
He actually went to Ireland. That's where he got his first job. Oh. But, yeah.
Because so people from Kenosha have a Wisconsin meets Chicago accent. So it's like, hi, I'm from Kenosha, Wisconsin. It's like so cute.
What is our accent?
I don't know. We don't have an accent because we're cool.
Oh.
We're just very hip, worldly people. So I don't know what a Wisconsin accent is. Probably the way I just said Wisconsin.
It's very nasally, yeah.
What is my accent?
Your accent?
All right, please continue, Samantha.
At an incredibly young age, he found his passion, this is Wells I'm talking about, for stage acting. After he had built a name for himself as an actor, he founded his own theater company called Mercury Theater. It was such a successful company that he made the cover of Time magazine on May 9th, 1938.
He was young, right?
On top of...
Time magazine is old.
On top of directing and...
Good comment, Michael.
I'm here too.
On top of directing and starring on the stage, Welles also found great success on the radio. In fact, his adaptation of War on the Worlds is arguably one of the most famous radio shows.
Do you guys think that Orson Welles is kind of goofy hot?
I think he's just straight up hot.
I was going to say you could remove the goofy.
No, because he's got kind of goofy face, but like a hot face. So.
I heard the whole reaction to the World and the Worlds thing was mythologized. That people didn't really believe it.
Right. So a lot of the descriptions I read was it was arguably now considered the first mockumentary, which I think is pretty interesting.
That is fun. I've heard that like there were actually people who thought it was an alien invasion, but it was greatly exaggerated to promote it.
Oh, sure. Worked on me. I know about it because of that.
So basically, Welles was a hot commodity. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much everything he made was gold. And Hollywood noticed.
He was like Aladdin's dad.
Pretty much.
Is that
did
what
you the- do an Aladdin 3 reference?
Just, Prince of Thieves? It's the best one. I'm saying it.
Yeah, I think everyone was clamoring for that hot reference.
Everyone's like, it's like, could have referenced Aladdin 3 right there. Just missed that. Missed that boat.
Oh boy.
So studio after studio was approaching him, offering him director roles, producer roles, and even studio head positions. However, Welles was very protective of his work. He liked working without a boss controlling his artistic process. But from what I read, not like in a super conceited way. Just sure, he liked the freedom. Sure. I don't know. His story is very interesting. I highly suggest anyone. This is such an overview, but he's a very interesting person. Anyways. Then he was offered what was considered the greatest contract offered to a filmmaker. RKO signed him with the agreement that he could write, produce, direct, and star in two films. He would have budget control, and most importantly and shockingly, he was given the right of deciding the final cut. Wow. Which
is that a big deal?
It's unheard of in general and never for a first-time director.
Is that true still today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no.
That's cool. That's a cool fact.
He just had a lot of say. Like, he got to decide who the cast was going to be. He brought in most of the cast actually from his theater production company. And so a lot of them would go on to become bigger stars. I don't mention any of their names because I don't actually recognize any of them. But apparently they were big stars.
Big stars.
And they had never been in films. He just brought them in. So, like, he had a lot of power in this film, which was very unheard of. Pretty amazing for a man of, well, that's your question of the week. How old was Orson Welles?
That's a great question.
When he co-wrote, directed, produced, and starred in Citizen Kane.
That's a great question.
Thank you.
Okay. I got my answer.
I have my answer as well.
I think he's younger than my guess, but I just want it to be mine. 32.
I think he's 28.
25.
What? Oh, that's crazy.
The Time magazine, he was 23.
That's stupid. That's, no 23-year-old should be that successful. Unless they're a pop star, that's going to just flame out.
I love it.
Wells was nervous about his first film, and to get himself ready, he watched John Ford's iconic Western, Stagecoach, at least 40 times. He would watch it with different members of his crew and then ask them how different techniques were accomplished.
That's not one we did, right?
No. We did John Ford, The Searchers.
And Treasure of Sierra Madre, is that John Ford?
Maybe.
Maybe.
No, wasn't it like Dad?
Or wasn't it Houston?
That was it, Houston. But we know things.
Later on in his life, he would be asked to name his cinematic influences, and he would answer, "The old masters, by who I mean John Ford, John Ford, and John Ford."
Aww. He's fine. I don't think we liked The Searchers at all.
I honestly don't remember like what he was talking about.
That was the John Wayne one where he had to search for his... Remember?
Now I do remember.
Oh, and he said, "Looks like I'm a searcher."
Mikey, that was the one he fought in the Civil War. He was looking for his niece,
who had been kidnapped.
All I remember is we were not impressed by John Wayne because he was very old.
Yeah, and not a good actor, maybe.
So to help with his film, Wells was approached by the iconic cinematographer Greg Tulland. Wells told him that he didn't know anything about movies, and Tulland responded, "I'm tired of working with people who know too much about it." The two would play off of each other, challenging and inventing with their freedom from the studio. Tolan modified cameras and lenses to create the film's famous deep focus shots. He also stretched muslins over the top of the
sets. He created a lens for this? That's so cool.
Oh, they kind of ran crazy.
So this film nonsense, like this nerdy shit is why people love this film, right? Like,
well, think about it as an opportunity. Like, you were given this very talented director, actor, everything, pretty much. He was very talented. And he was just given kind of unlimited power by a pretty well-known studio.
But then he also like had a person who could like invent new technology.
Yeah, so
it's like Avatar.
Tolland was already like a well-known cinematographer, and basically now he's given the opportunity. Hold on, I have this great quote from Wells. He said, "In this case, I had a cameraman who didn't care if he was criticized if he failed, and I didn't know that there were things you couldn't do. So anything that I could think up in my dreams, I attempted to photograph."
That's cool.
So basically, like, he would just be like, "I've never made a film. Do you think we could do this?" And he's like, "Yeah, sure, why not?" Apparently, like, they would cut the floor and put holes in it so they could get the cameras even lower. Like, they just went crazy.
That's really fun.
Yeah.
One reason why I really like this film, and maybe you can answer this question for me, but I always gather a lack of pretension from Orson Welles. I've told you guys this fun fact, but he was interviewed about Citizen Kane, and the interview's like...
"That one scene where you suddenly cut to a cockatoo screeching just before..."
"That was to wake up the audience."
"It's as simple as that."
"That's the entire significance of the cockatoo."
And I just feel like that's Orson Welles' whole thing. He's really not like, "Oh, this means a lot."
Like, this is like how the freedom of a bird is actually squelched in our modern society.
No, and for him to be like, "You know, I don't know shit about film, so just do whatever."
I like that.
Yeah, I think that's very accurate. So another talent that Welles found was aspiring makeup artist Maurice Siderman. He noticed Siderman experimenting with latex to create face applications and asked him to work on Citizen Kane. Siderman, who was like not in the union, he was literally sweeping the floors in the makeup department, would use his applications to create the look of older Kane. And since then, latex face applications are now common practice in movie makeup special effects.
It's fair to say it fooled us. We thought he was older than 25.
Well, I think he's just a young guy who looks a bit older. Because, like, some of the old age stuff did not
age well. Can you give him any credit?
I think Orson Welles is doing fine.
He's dead.
He's dead.
In the grave.
I mean, I don't think, like, people don't remember who he is. He's fine.
I actually think you guys will appreciate this next fact.
Oh, I'm
I thought
so
this
excited.
Was great. So, in an earlier scene in the film, specifically, it's the scene where he's, like, talking about, "Oh, I will lose a million every year. And it looks like I will run out in 60 years. You know that scene? Okay. It's where he looks really hot.
He is so hot.
Wells appears to be the same age on screen as he was in real life at that point.
Okay.
However, to give the polished look of the rich Kane, Wells had temporary facelifts. That's where they'd actually like put fishing wire and they'd tape it to your face and then they pull your face. So like you
they did that in Mrs. Doubtfire.
They also did it in Hunger Games.
I never saw Hunger Games.
So they had that done and they did specific hairstyling to make him look more beautiful and extravagant. And Wells would express frustration later on in his life when people would say that he didn't age well. And they would point to that picture and be like, look at how hot he was when he was young. And he'd point out, I never looked that good in real life. That was all like makeup. I aged fine. I didn't look that good originally.
Oh, it's too bad.
It's cute.
It's too bad that people are so judgmental in today's society.
Typical Hollywood.
God.
That being said, Wells was not in pristine health while filming. Wells suffered from caffeine poisoning while on set.
Is that a thing?
From drinking more than 30 cups of coffee a day.
What?
Wait.
How does he even have the time?
Then he gets better. So after his poisoning episode, he decided to switch to tea, thinking that the manual act of making the tea would slow down his drinking. But he just got one of his assistants to make the tea. And he ended up drinking so much tea that the one herb in it actually started tinting his skin.
Whoa.
Jesus
Christ. Good thing he works in black and white.
Jesus.
Speaking of hurting himself, Wells only took one take for the scene where he violently trashes his ex-wife's room. He was so immersed, he cut both of his hands and didn't realize it and kept filming. Afterwards, he simply said, I really felt it.
Wow. That's a cute joke.
Although he had a shocking amount of power, Wells did still have a budget he had to follow, and he wasn't great at following it. But there were some shortcuts he had to make, and one of the shortcuts he took was reusing a shot from a previous film on a scene on the beach that needed birds flying in the background. The movie borrowed from that they borrowed the scene from was King Kong, and the birds in the background were actually pterodactyls.
Oh, that's a fun fact.
Although he had a lot of power and control, executives would still occasionally visit the set. During these visits, the crew were told, don't do anything, smoke cigarettes, and talk. As for Wells, he would do card tricks. According to one head, he would invite us over, but he'd keep us outside the screening and then do tricks and stuff to amuse us.
Aww.
He really just wanted to keep the project to himself, which he did for a long time. But as it's well known, eventually things slip out. This movie is loosely based off of the life and career of William Randolph Hearst. Technically, he never said it was, but he...
There are some parts in this movie that are, like, so obvious.
There's one line he says that's literally, like, if I was in college, it would be me knocking off a famous quote as my own. It's, like, the one, like, if
the
you...
The Spanish-American War
thing,
if
you provide this, I'll provide a war or something.
Oh, God, now I forget what the line is. But, yeah, it's totally a knockoff of what... William Randolph Hearst said about creating the Spanish-American War.
Yeah, it's 100% loosely based. But anyways, so Hearst was a very influential newspaper owner.
Oh, you provide the headlines, I'll provide the war.
There you go. And to say he was less than thrilled to have a movie made about him would be a slight understatement. One of his columnists, Luella Parsons, who was like a big-time columnist at the time, she requested a private screening of the film before it was released. She left outraged before the film even ended, though apparently her driver stayed behind, watched the whole film, and said it was very good.
Okay, so I'm an idiot. He was actually talking to his famous illustrator of Hearst newspapers, and he said to him, you furnish the pictures, and I'll furnish the war.
There you go.
So I was close.
You were close. So after she left the film, she demanded to speak to the studio head and stated that they would face the most beautiful lawsuit in history if the movie was released. Hearst banned all of his newspaper empire from advertising the film. He actually started off by banning anything coming out of RKO. And then about 2 months later was like, just Citizen Kane. Numerous theater chains also refused to show it out of fear of retribution from Hearst. Wells was once told by a policeman that an underage, undressed girl and a photographer were waiting for him at his hotel room courtesy of Hearst. Like trying to... You know,
gross.
Get a bad picture of him and then they could discredit him. So he just found another place to sleep that night. He never went back to his room. But apparently, like, he was threatened with, I'm going to tell everyone about your affair. He was having an affair with a married woman at the time. Maybe not the best thing to do. Well... but just like Hearst was doing all these very dirty things to kind of try and get both him discredited. He kept calling him a communist in the papers. Stuff like that.
That'll do it.
Hearst and Wells would only meet once. It was when they shared an elevator in San Francisco where the film was premiering. In the elevator, Wells offered Hearst free tickets to the premiere. But Hearst refused to even acknowledge the director. As Hearst left the elevator, Wells called after him. Charles Forster Kane would have accepted. Partially due to the lack of theaters willing to show the film, Citizen Kane was a box office flop. It did not even make it make up the cost of the film. The studio was so embarrassed it was quickly put into the vaults and would not be re-released to the public until the mid-1950s. Despite the hate, the film was nominated for 9 Academy Awards. It was expected to win all. It would end up winning one. Anytime it was announced at the ceremony, the crowd would boo.
Why?
Because Hearst has power, man.
Oh. Damn.
It was nominated for, but did not win, Outstanding Motion Picture, Best Actor for Orson Welles, Best Director Orson Welles, Best Art Direction, Black and White, Best Cinematography, Black and White, Best Film Editing, Best Music, and Best Sound Recording. The only thing it would win was Best Writing for the screenplay, and it was split between Orson Welles and his writing partner, Herman Mankiewicz.
Sure.
That was a lot of syllables.
On top of being number one in our AFI list, we also have a quote coming in at number 17 on the AFI quote list.
Rosebud.
Exactly. And my final fact for you guys today, despite all the tension. So Hearst has a giant castle that actually I believe your parents have been to. And Aunt Joyce. Hey, Aunt Joyce.
Shout out.
And it's, you know, he just had a lot of money and a lot of power. So he has this beautiful rich castle. He had like his own
zoo and
everything.
But all he was looking for was love.
What voice is that?
That's my accent. That's how I talk.
I'm from Wisconsin.
So anyways, he had this beautiful, gorgeous castle, and in, obviously this movie was banned from ever being viewed there. However, in 2012, the Hearst estate agreed to screen the film at the Hearst castle, breaking the ban on the film.
That's really fun.
And they did it, I think, for a charity. It was $1,000 a piece, and there was only like 90 tickets. So
fun.
Damn.
But imagine watching Citizen Kane in the Hearst Castle.
Very cool.
With the pterodactyls flying around.
That's fun. And that was...
Bam!
Time for Sam. I think that voice was my Katharine Hepburn voice.
Me saying, bam! Or are you doing your voice?
He just wanted love.
I thought that was your King Kong. It was beauty that killed the beast.
Maybe it's just my old-timey voice.
Yeah, you have one voice.
That was really great. Isn't Sam the coolest, like, most awesome person?
Sam, here's the thing. This is truth. And she's not here, so I could say this honestly.
Oh.
She's very cool.
Wow.
Yeah, when she listens to this later, she's going to be surprised.
I'm super honored.
Although she didn't mention how The Sims, you can type in Rosebud as a cheat code to get 1,000 simoleons.
But it's like, is that what you really need? Here's my... This is not the first time I've referenced this cartoon. Tiny Toon Adventures.
This is a gun. Yeah, it's a thing.
Podcast. They did a parody of this where the rich kid, Monty... shouted out Acme, and they had to figure out what it was, and in the end it was his childhood toy. But and then in the end of the episode he's like, no, I was just shouting Acme because I got a pimple.
Aww,
that was the bit.
That's a good bit.
Yeah,
I don't know if we're gonna be that funny.
No,
we're no.
So that brings us to our next segment.
Critics Corner,
where we see what discerning critics of the film have to say about it.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't I start out?
All right.
This stuff is fine theater, technically or any other way. And along with them, the film is exciting for the recklessness of its independence, even if it seems to have little to be free for. I don't get what that means. Otis Ferguson of the New Republic. Maybe I don't get why this is absolutely number one. Like, why is it the best film ever?
Here's from that one guy. And I feel like I would like to be a writer sometime, just on my, as a hobby, you know? Okay. But I will never be as creative as this next sentence.
Are you ready?
A great big snore. At least the sled provided plenty of opportunities for comedic parody over the years. Unfortunately, as a whole, the film has no redeeming qualities.
Wow,
That one guy, Amazon reviewer. That's crazy.
I put that in because I knew you would love to say a bore, a great big snore.
Yes.
A film in which every minute is planned. Everything works. Not a second wasted. Not a frame too much. Stripped to the gears and yet rich with cinematic decoration.
Oh.
Said Dwight McDonald, the Esquire magazine.
That is an unfortunate name to have. Dwight McDonald.
I'm into it.
Well, I mean, he's probably bullied, is all I'm saying.
Aw, poor Dwight.
Poor Dwight. Sorry. This is from Juan Li Po, an Amazon reviewer. Some people are trying to praise Citizen Kane. It doesn't work. It's like someone trying to perfume poop. They don't realize that poop is poop. No matter how hard they try to make it smell good, it still stinks.
Wow. Wow.
That is harsh, man.
That's harsh. It is a triumph of film and proof of its solid value and of the sense of its director and all concerned that a human touch is not lost.
Oh,
sympathy for the preposterous Mr. Kane survives. Indeed, there is something about him which seems admirable, said John C. Mosher of The New Yorker.
Hmm. Do you read The New Yorker?
I probably have in my life, but I do not regularly read The New Yorker.
Why not?
Because I'm too dumb.
This is from Bobby. This is one. Okay, here we go. I love what one of the reviews below said about people not having to pretend to be smart to like Citizen Kane. I'm not pretending to be smart. I may be dumb, but I know a good movie when I see one. This is not one of those.
Can you read the next one too?
Sure. Oh, this is from another Amazon reviewer. This film is in black and white, which means I can't even see the ogre. What the fuck? I can't even see the ogre's green. This film not does have layers. Is dumb. Shrek is love. Shrek is life.
I just needed someone to come cold to that reading. To those at home are like, Michael really stumbled on that. There was no punctuation in that. So
that was my favorite review so far. I learned a lot.
Film does not have layers. Is dumb. Shrek is love. Shrek is life.
I love Donkey. Let's go to our next segment, favorite least favorite part.
Michael, what was your least favorite part?
I feel like the film, for being the number one best film of all time, and maybe I already said this in the opening, but it's not very meaningful. When you get the reveal that, oh, Rosebud is his childhood. I don't feel like that recontextualizes the film.
No, I think the overarching emotional thing of the film is like, oh, he just wants to be loved, but you can't buy that. And it's like, it's quite a juvenile, isn't it? It like makes sense that a 25-year-old would make this film and think this is really deep.
Here's off track. I watched a YouTube video. Actually, it was that video upstairs that we didn't finish watching. And they mentioned American History X. Have you ever seen that film? Mm-mm. Where it's about neo-Nazis?
I do know that, yeah.
And it's like really critiquing it, but some people watch it and they think, oh, neo-Nazis are cool. Oh,
I've read that before, yeah. Like, because the iconography and the imagery like makes it look pretty cool, even though they're watching the film wrong.
And I've never seen the film. But the one fear presented by the video was like, well, they don't concentrate on the victims at all. And that's a real problem. That's why you can easily sympathize with it. And so all I'm saying with this whole thing is that if this movie, if the point of it is like, man, William Randolph Hearst was a bad guy, they didn't really do that, because you just see a guy who's sad and you empathize with him at the end.
My thread is very, it really leads to my least favorite part.
Yeah.
Where I don't think the movie was supposed to be such a bad guy. It's like, oh, he's just sad and he doesn't really understand love and we should all empathize. I thought that was the point of the movie, but I thought there was the only thing he did a thing that was kind of irredeemable in my eyes, which was bully and emotionally terrorize his young wife.
And, well, he did that to everybody, yeah.
But especially doing it to his young wife in such a persistent way that we got to see on screen. And then You know, and then there's this cut to scene where the reporter goes, well, I really feel sorry for him. And she's like, you don't think
I was just about to say that's my least favorite part of the film when she says that.
And she's like, you don't think I feel sorry for him. And it's like her life was destroyed by him and he's fine. Like, but, actually.
But that's like the end of the film. That's how we conclude.
Right. And I mean, I'm going to go like annoying feminist SJW.
Jesus Christ.
I know. But. This is sort of a through line in our society that is getting a little better, where we do sort of just give rich white men the benefit of the doubt. And like when they do wrong things, it's like, but isn't it because they're just so sad and broken inside in a way that we maybe don't to people who aren't like them? And yeah, this seems very indicative of that. But of course, it's of a time and it makes sense. And people who are like this probably do have sad backstories, but they also get zero repercussions for it. And why do we also have to sympathize for them in death? It just seems, again, it's not really a criticism because a lot of movies I love are like this. It does just have a very, it's not that deep. It's pretty easy.
Oh, it's not deep
at all.
It's
pretty juvenile, I guess, in its emotional core.
I agree with that 100%. Yeah, if A Christmas Story ended with Scrooge being bad, but it's like, well, now we know why he's bad. It's like, well, that he's still bad.
Right. But now we get it.
Oh, now I understand. It's so deep.
Oh, it's so sad. What's your favorite part of this movie?
This is just how I feel. I feel like there is a lack of pretension and there is a lot of silliness and lighthearted.
That's such a funny thing to like about like the number one best film.
Really feel that way. Of silly and dorky. It's kind of a dorky film. I mean, I'm thinking of when he's at the dinner with his first wife and there's a lot of time skips and the camera just like spins around and she's talking to him but with different costumes on because it's like different time periods.
I love that
scene, but it's like really silly.
I love the gimmicks in this film. That's actually not my favorite part. My favorite part is I kind of like the storyline. Like, I like this sort of,
we just criticized the storyline.
No, not the emotional core of it. I just kind of like seeing him get worse and worse and crazier, and it's just kind of fun.
I like the opening 10 minutes where it starts. I mean, I guess we'll say this in 4 seconds, but it starts with a like, Citizen Kane, here's who he is. Here's a blah, blah, blah. He had a life, he was in politics, and that's the end. And we're like, what is it? Is this the movie? Are we watching the right thing?
And then it's like, yeah.
And then it was actually a pretty good setup. I like the setup to this film as well.
I did too. I just think all the acting was also pretty good. And even if it wasn't like the best acting we've seen, I just enjoyed everyone's performance. Does that make sense?
Orson Welles did a great job. Susan did a great job.
Yeah, I guess
everyone did a great job. But it's not deep. It's just kind of silly and fun.
Yeah, which is probably,
but that's fine.
Not right. Like, we're probably wrong.
No. We are right. We are for sure right.
I mean, everybody in the AFI was like, this is the most profound, amazing film ever made.
I think it's not profound, but it's also fine that it isn't profound. Like, I'm totally fine with it. I'm not angry at this film at all.
I'm not angry at it. I'm just, I think that's not why most people think it's the best movie of all time.
I think it's cool to like a film like this. That's why. Like, oh, they didn't get it at its time, and it's so revolutionary.
But yeah, no, it's fun.
And they, for some reason, are always whispering.
So we like it correctly.
We like it the exact correct amount.
Suck it, people who understand film.
Losers. Why, now is part of the show. We go through the intern summary. We have an intern, by the way. Let's establish that. And he or she wrote a whole summary about the film that we are now going to read.
And Michael is the worst boss who doesn't even know the gender of our intern.
I am very unattached to this employee. I mean, employee is strong. Intern.
Michael.
They're not getting paid.
Go on.
It's unpaid internship. We open the movie with a long panning shot of a huge castle mansion with a big fence around it. A quick shot inside the house shows us the mouth of an old man who whispers, Rosebud, before dropping a snow globe and dying.
This is a weird thing to say, but like more than one person was like, but nobody was in the room with him. How did they know? And I'm like, I don't know why. I didn't bother me. I didn't care.
It would have been fun though if we thought of it. If we thought of it,
yeah, then it would have been very clever and insightful.
Here's a clever thing.
A newsreel flashes across the screen and tells us all about the life and death of Charles Foster Kane, the dude we just saw die. Apparently, Kane was a super rich fellow who used to own a newspaper empire that spanned the entire United States. But now he's dead, and the news reporters want to find out what he meant by saying Rosebud as his last word.
Do you think this is realistic at all?
I don't really get how newsreels work, but I didn't get that they were that competitive. Like, we're going to spend a ton of money, make our reporters travel and talk to a million people to get like the most interesting newsreel. But it seems like what they had was fine. But
he died is quite clickbait. You know, you're going to get the clicks.
The clicks of people just going to the movie theater. Like, so do movie theaters, do they look at several newsreels and like, this one's the most interesting one. We'll pay for that one. I don't get how it works. I don't know the business.
You know
it
what?
Might be it.
No, it's not right. Okay. Thompson, is that a guy?
Sorry. He's the reporter that they send out to find about Rosebud.
The reporter first interviews Kane's ex-wife, Susan Alexander Kane, which is his second wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who works as a dancer and singer in a dingy bar. I love Susan.
Yeah, I do too.
Susan is drunk and uncooperative. A waiter hovers over her and tells her that Thompson that Susan has been unwilling to talk about Kane since he died, although she spoke of him often when he was alive. Thompson then goes to the bank that houses the memoirs of Kane's childhood guardian, Walter Parks Thatcher. As Thompson begins to read those memoirs, the image of the page dissolves into a flashback to Kane's childhood.
In the diary, Kane's mother, Mary, runs a boarding house in rural Colorado. In lieu of a payment, one of her tenants gives her some stock in what she thinks is a worthless mine. It turns out to give her ownership of the Colorado Lode, a working gold mine. Finding herself suddenly wealthy, she decides to send her son away, Charles, to be raised by her banker, Thatcher. Which, by the way, I read in something else that she was also sending him away to like protect him from the abusive father. I didn't get that at all.
I didn't understand the scene at all.
Actually didn't understand why he was rich, really. Like, this is something I had to read about.
What?
But now I get it.
Was she disowning the child?
I read that like the abusive father, she didn't want the father to run his life or anything, and she wanted him to get away and take the money.
This probably is my least favorite scene because it was just not delivered in a way.
Apparently it was really important.
That made sense to me.
Charles is understandably upset and whacks Thatcher with the sled he's been happily riding.
Important.
Kane,
remember the sled?
I remember it. Kane grew up to
That's our Wisconsin accent coming through.
Kane grew up to be a rebellious guy who thought it would be fun to run a newspaper to attack the wealthy class of America.
I wasn't really set up. I mean, he's really about running a newspaper, but like, why?
Because that would be fun.
I do like that he says that. When he's done reading Thatcher's diary, Thompson visits Mr. Bernstein, a guy who served as Kane's right-hand man when he took over the first newspaper, the New York Inquirer. Unlike Thatcher, Bernstein is sympathetic toward Kane and says he was one of the greatest men in America. But he also admits that Kane has let his pride get the best of him, especially when he ran for governor and ended up destroying his public reputation by having an affair with a woman named Susan Alexander.
And Susan was so sweet.
I thought she was a good singer.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
After talking to Bernstein, Thompson goes to visit Kane's ex-best friend, Jebediah Leland. Leland tells
cool
the story.
Name.
Very cool. Tells the story of how Kane went from a young idealist to a bitter old egomaniac that tried to use his fortune to force people to love him. Again, this is pretty silly. Over the years, Leland tried to point out Kane's faults, but Kane eventually fired him for disloyalty when he wrote a scathing review of Susan Alexander's singing.
Whoa, we're zipping through this.
Oh, we are. But then I kind of go back a bit.
Here's maybe a flaw of the film. I'm not a writer. But if you are pacing out a character arc of a film, I feel like the character arc in this film happens very fast.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like
we are
within the
racing.
No, I mean, this is a 2-hour film, but I feel like at 20 minutes in, you're like, oh, so he didn't love anybody and he paid for love. Like you already got his end conclusion.
Oh, I totally
right
agree
away. You're not really learning anything as the film goes on.
I guess it just gets worse.
Yeah, but I mean, it's there.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. It's me?
Yep.
After talking to Bernstein.
Speaking of which.
Thompson goes to visit Kane's.
Nope, I just read that.
Speaking of which. That's why he said that. After marrying Susan Alexander, Kane decided to put all of his energy and money into making her a famous singer. But apparently, even though he built an opera house just for her, the movie tells us Susan doesn't have the talent.
There's this scene where she's in the opera house and she's singing. And like Michael said, I thought she was fine.
Well, go ahead.
And so like she's singing opera and I'm like, all right, I don't know anything about opera, but this sounds fine. But then they pan up to a stagehand who's making a P-U motion. I'm like, okay, so this is bad.
I have two feelings. That stagehand would say like, oh, it's fine. Because like, what does the stagehand know about
he
opera?
He works in an opera house. He knows everything about opera. He's seen 8 million operas.
That's a really good point, actually.
You're so classist.
I am very classist. He's poor, so he probably doesn't know a lot. But here's what I think also. I did think she was a good singer, but I thought she was fine. But then I saw her with the vocal instructor, and I'm like, okay, I guess she's not that good. Because the vocal instructor is so good.
He was so... Well, so he said in their singing lesson, he's like, some people are good and some people are bad. You're bad. And I'm like, she's not that bad. Like,
but
she's not...
he would sing too, and it's like, okay, well, that... Yeah, there's a contrast.
He was like, she's beyond help. And it's like, what?
I heard it.
I actually Googled, like, is she supposed to be bad? Because I didn't really get it. And someone wrote that they had a real soprano dub her voice. Or sorry, a real opera singer. But the opera singer was an alto voice doing a soprano voice to make it seem like she was quite in her range. Which is like, no, I'm an idiot. You need to be shit. Like, you need to really be bad for me to get what's happening here.
I bought it because that opera singer, the instructor, when he was singing, like, you need to sing like this. And then compared with her.
I need to sing like this.
And I'm like, nothing.
You suck.
You suck, Susan.
But those scenes, I thought they were pretty hard to watch because, like, you know, he was an asshole, but that's when he was abusive. When she was, like, crying and she's like, nobody likes me. I'm humiliated. I'm not good at this. And I don't even really want to sing. And he's like, you will sing. You will sing.
I guess it's fine then for that, because that is the apex of his arc then.
That's the worst of it.
And it does happen at the end of the film. So I guess I was being incorrect when I said his arc peaks early.
I just thought it was so...
It's hard to watch.
Because she's so lovely and young and he's so gross. And I don't know.
Weird that, like, you're right? But I was so compelled by the line where he slaps her and she goes, don't say you're sorry.
Don't tell me you're sorry.
That was really good. That was so good.
And I'm like, it gave me tingles. I'm like, I like watching this for some reason.
I don't mean to ruin it, but that's again what bothered me so much about the you don't think I don't feel sorry for him. And it's like,
that's a bad shitty line.
That's your abuser. So you don't have to feel sorry for him. And that fucking reporter, like, should feel bad about himself for asking that of her.
It sucks that the movie ends like that.
But anyway,
Eventually, she gets him to give up on the scheme, and they moved together into Kane's great castle mansion in Florida called Xanadu.
Xanadu's a cool name.
It's a cool name. Hey, here's the thing. I thought they had chemistry in the first scene. We kind of skipped over it.
Yeah, they were so
cute.
But
it's weird how he still felt like the old, craggly old man, and she was the young thing, but you still...
I actually did kind of get it. Like, they were cute together in the very first scene.
They were cute together, even though they were totally in character.
Yeah, like, I buy this gross affair.
I bought it, too.
Next, Thompson revisits Susan Alexander and asks her about the time she spent with Kane living at Xanadu. Susan finally gives the hot goss, saying it was a life of total isolation and boredom.
Goss is two S's.
Yeah, gossip. Okay. It's a short for gossip.
Nice.
So it was a life of total isolation, boredom, and jigsaw puzzles. Those were really fun, huge jigsaw puzzles.
I mean, the pieces were so weirdly shaped, too.
I loved it.
I was jealous.
And she would just be like, can we just go out? And he's like, no, we must invite people here. We will go on a picnic, Susan.
Susan.
In fact, she got so fed up with Kane that she left him. He threw a total fit and whispered the word Rosebud after she had gone.
At the end of the film, we're almost done. We got two paragraphs left. The end of the movie, Thompson visits Xanadu to speak with Kane's butler, Raymond. He also has no clue what Kane meant by saying the word Rosebud is dead, but said Kane has uttered it before. Thompson finally gives up and decided he'll never figure it out. Plus, he figures that even if he found out, it probably wouldn't bring closure that everyone wanted.
What a waste of money. Like, I just don't understand the business of newsreels, I guess. In the movie's final shot, we get a look at a room full of Kane's old possessions. Among these is Rosebud, the sled that Kane owned as a child.
Oh, so he, like, had a sad childhood.
It's like a lost childhood. And as the movie ends, a mover picks up the sled and tosses it into an incinerator. Get it?
It just doesn't, like, reframe the film in any meaningful way.
No, it's like, oh, it's okay, he's an asshole because he had a sad.
And it just makes it upsetting to watch it again because every time they talk about the slide, it's like, I already know what it is. It's like, it's not.
Who watches this nowadays and doesn't know the. I mean, okay, if you watch this and didn't know that, that wouldn't be like a. crazy. It's not I See Dead People, right?
It's not I See Dead People. Sixth Sense is better than this film.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Sixth Sense is so good.
I love Bruce Willis.
Everyone should watch Sixth Sense.
Hey, John, welcome to Flaherty's on Films. We're talking about Citizen Kane.
Have you seen it? What do you think?
Yes, so I have seen it.
Best movie ever?
What?
Best movie ever?
You know, it's interesting in that I saw it a few weeks ago, and that movie is... It's a movie... compared to many other... I mean, unlike many other movies, that's a movie that ages well in the mind.
Whoa.
In the mind. That's an interesting way to say it.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm kind of tired. I'm already in bed. You know this.
No, we don't.
This is brand new information.
Right. I didn't enjoy it that much while watching it, but thinking back on it, thinking how I feel, I find I appreciate it a ton more.
Sure.
And I'm specifically thinking, like, the overall tone of the movie wasn't really clear to me until, like, two-thirds of the way through, and then thinking back, I really get that sense, that deep sense of melancholy, which really is driven through the
movie. Yeah, it's a bummer.
It's silly and lighthearted in some parts.
It's a bummer, too.
In some parts, but that actually serves to heighten the melancholy, right? Like, the parts of him as a young man, and how he's kind of fun, lighthearted, and just doing stuff, and it really contrasts so hard with how sad he is later in life.
Right, because it is all about his lost childhood. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it really actually, I mean, I didn't like it that much while watching it, but thinking back, I really do. So if you would have called me right after the fact, I would have said, oh, yeah.
We did! That's what happened!
That's what happened, John!
Right.
So, what grade do you give it?
I also thought, like, while watching it, the acting was terrible. Like, outside of Orson Welles, who was amazing, all the actors seemed atrocious.
Oh,
and then, of
course,
at the end of the movie, it says, oh, by the way, all these are first-time actors.
I didn't think they were that bad.
I thought they were good.
I did not think they were that good. I thought they were really, really bad. Outside of Orson Welles, who, that was the main actor's name, right?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, I loved
him. He was amazing. Just amazing.
Agreed.
And the way they aged him was so good. I think one thing that movie, or two things that movie really had going for it was the aging of him, that effect in total, and the weird structure of the movie was really interesting. I liked that a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those are some good thoughts. What grade do you give it?
I give it a B+.
All right.
Mostly because that's what I gave it to Sam when she texted me earlier.
Okay. John, thank you so much for joining us. I know you're in bed and I know it's your birthday, but you better have some great thoughts about The Matrix later. Bye.
Bye.
Who are we sponsored by this week?
Apparently to this fucking Google Doc. We're sponsored by Facebook. Why are we sponsored by Facebook?
Facebook was reached out and they're like, wow, Flaherty's on Films really engaged a lot of users and some really lovely content. And we're like, wow, you guys did it. Here, have some money.
Did they do that for real?
They did it for real. They're like, great job, guys. Facebook, it's like, if you want to hang out with your grandma and organize, I don't know, sell your sofa, you can do both those things on Facebook.
Isn't Mark Zuckerberg a bad guy?
Probably. I mean, yeah. If you guys don't like Facebook, it's fine. You don't have to be on Facebook. Unless you're following Flaherty's on Films page.
Oh, yeah. Please do like our page. I don't know if that does anything for us.
Yeah. It's fun. Then you can see when our new shows come out and we can get out announcements. And thank you so much to everybody who contributed to our new AFI list, which we will be embarking on after this next
episode.
And they
can contribute at any time if they just want.
They can still contribute. It's right there on our Facebook
page.
But
for perpetuity. I mean, they can just say whenever,
even as the new list is happening, tell us about other movies because we love it.
And we're really smart about films and our opinions matter a lot.
They matter so much.
And Sam will do facts about it. So you got the whole deal. You got our opinions, Sam's facts. What else is there?
What else
John's
is
facts.
There?
I almost fucking forgot. That's going to do it for us this week at Flaherty on Films.
And cut.